The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, there's a particular mountain bike ride here in Durango that is particularly difficult. A lot of climbing, but you've got these peaks that you get to and they're always false summits, and it drives you nuts because you're tired, you look at the summit, you think you're just about done, you come up over the top, you've got another false summit. And over and over and over. And, you know, that's reminding me of Washington, D.C. right now. You know, fiscal cliff, all the nervousness. Whew, it's been averted. I think that was a false summit.
Kevin, I thought for sure you were going to mention Star Wars. It's the ride that I always go over the handlebars on. And I think that's a lot like Washington, D.C. right now, too. There's a point in the road where if you don't get off and walk your bike, or perhaps if you're a skilled rider, you don't have to. But I typically do go over my handlebars on that one particular section. Yep, false peak after false peak after false peak. You know, I don't usually stop and listen to the news on Fox News or Bloomberg or CNBC, but I thought listening to the final press conference of Obama's first term might be worth a couple of minutes. And of course, folks in the office said you might want to just move along. Your blood pressure is probably going to rise as theirs was already.
Right.
You know, and it did start out with a very bipartisan tone. Press Corps, unfortunately, very quickly got under his skin, and the quote-unquote conversation that he was willing to have with the Republicans started to sound like it entailed sitting down with an inmate to discuss sort of reforming bad behavior.
Well, and David, I hate to say this, but you know, we've got a president right now that does not like to be questioned on anything that he hasn't already told you can ask him.
Well, in the interview, compromise was sounding like sort of a dictation of supreme will. He would not compromise. There was no compromise. There was no discussion. It was final. Either you get on board or else. Mm. And it's ironic that as the president, he feels so adamantly about raising the debt ceiling when Mr. Obama, as a junior senator, voted against raising the debt ceiling and, in fact, went so far as to say this. I quote from 2006, "The fact that we are here today to debate raising the debt limit is a sign of leadership failure." Now, I guess if the shoe fits, you might
right.
have to wear it. It is a sign, back to the quote, "It is a sign that the U.S. government can't pay its own bills. It is a sign that we now depend on ongoing financial assistance from foreign countries to finance our government's reckless fiscal policies."
Well, and David, I remember that, and that was definitely a grandstand moment, because if you'll recall, when he was a senator, he wasn't there very often, but when he had the camera, that was one of those situations where, you know, he knew that he could go on record just slapping the Republicans around. Now he's in the same situation.
It was an impressive lecture, but I would ask the president, which fiscal policies did you have in mind which are categorically reckless? We have the largest fiscal commitments, which are in fact non-compulsory. When we discuss paying our debt obligations, that is specifically making payments on or servicing roughly $10 trillion in actual IOUs, it is a defined universe.
Right.
Defense is not a debt or interest payment. Social Security is not a debt or interest payment. Medicare is not a debt or interest payment. The increased salaries of Congress approved in recent weeks are not a debt or interest payment. In fact, you have to go down to the fourth line item. It's the fourth largest item, but it is fourth on the list. That is an actual debt. That is interest on the national debt, which comes in at about $30 billion a month. $30 billion a month, which is important.
So, David, what you're saying is we can make payments on the debt. If they're going to call it the debt, we can still make payments, the interest payments, because the revenue's coming in at least to pay the interest with these rates where they're at now.
Well, sure, with $200 billion in tax revenue each month and $30 billion a month in interest payments, pay some principal on top of that, and we have what we need to make payments on our debt and avoid default. The argument that the Republicans are holding America hostage and bringing us to a default scenario is entirely inaccurate. It's default. That theme of default is an utter red herring.
Okay, so David, this is just basically misuse of a term. They're calling it debt and saying that it's unpayable, we have to raise it, but actually, they're doing that. They're tying their horse right now to entitlement programs and other bills that are not part of the debt.
Well, these are political obligations, but there's a difference between a political obligation and what is, in fact, debt. The White House has very disingenuously tied the budget into our debt obligations, conflating the issue over whether or not we will face a debt downgrade or go through a default scenario. Now, including things, as we mentioned, in the debt category, which are not debts. If you look at Friday's Wall Street Journal, they had a superb discussion on this, pointing out, and I quote, the obligations protected as debts by the 14th Amendment do not include entitlement programs such as Medicare and Social Security. These programs are not a part of the, quote, public debt.
They're bills.
Right. You know, which again, the actual debt consists of loans made to the federal government through bonds and similar financial instruments.
Right.
This is just political rhetoric. And frankly, it's political rhetoric at its worst. It's confusing the populace and misplacing blame for a non-issue.
Okay. Well, let's talk about legality here, Dave, because in reality, the government has to follow the law. Now, I know sometimes they would like to tell us that they're above that, but there is a law that says we have to pay our debts, using that word. And that's what's being addressed right now. But you're saying it's also being mixed with all these other commitments.
Well, exactly. And there is no legal obligation to borrow money to pay for entitlements or even defense spending. To do so neglects the vastly overlooked moral obligation. I think this is really what should drive us mad as a society. A moral obligation to future generations.
Yeah, because, so you're talking about our kids.
Yeah, because debt is a deferral of tax. It's a deferral of tax, one which will be paid by future generations. Mm-hmm. It's a bill being accrued in the present. It's being accrued in the present for which we, in the present, are not held responsible. It's our children, it's our grandchildren who are saddled with the task of payment, saddled with larger and larger debts. We're essentially eviscerating the quality of life that they will lead. You know, if you think of it this way, we're limiting their opportunities and hobbling their efforts of achieving something that we've had access to, namely the American dream. In essence, we're passing the tab to them while prioritizing our own consumptive habits, the benefits that we receive in the here and now, because we think, frankly, we're more important.
Well, and you know, put yourself in their shoes, Dave. Let's say that when we were in our teens and in our 20s and we were first getting jobs, that we actually weren't paying for our own debts, but we were paying for debts from our grandparents, maybe that had taken place back in the 30s, 20s, 30s, 40s. How inspiring would that be?
I like that thought experiment, particularly if you go back to the 1920s and you look at the roaring 20s, a lifestyle which was extravagant, champagne every night, you name it, you could have it. Now, it didn't mean that you were paying for it in the here and now. You might be paying for it next week, next month, next year.
Right.
But then you don't have the money to pay for all of the extravagance and you just pass that on to your grandchildren. Your grandchildren look back and say, what did we pay for? Was it a better America, or was it for extravagance that was unnecessary? And to some degree, that's what we've done, is we've made political commitments, not debt obligations, but political commitments, which they are trying to stay true to, but for political reasons, not because actually we're on the verge of a debt or default.
Well, and you know, just in case somebody's wondering, we're not talking about a Democrat versus Republican issue. This is Democrats and Republicans. This is a Republican issue. The Republicans are responsible too.
Yeah, the Republicans have on more than one occasion done the same thing and raised the generational burden to pass on to our heirs. What makes politics, frankly, a disgusting human endeavor is that people pretend to be on the side of truth, but are all too willing to flip-flop conveniently to posture with the party, both parties here,
right,
and win points in the short run, unfortunately, with a very misinformed electorate.
Well, and not just misinformed. In many ways, it's out of our control. You know, you cast your vote, and then you have to go about your day and earn the money that they're going to take.
Well, it's both parties which are complicit in the current level of debt, and both parties that have all too gladly raised the ceiling. You know how many times they've raised the debt ceiling thus far?
No.
107 times. This is not new. We have done this over and over again. It's not a Republican issue. It's not a Democrat issue. Anyone who's trying to grandstand and say, here on principle, we must draw a line in the sand, or here on principle, we must not hobble ourselves, destroy the economy, we must raise the debt ceiling, understand that it is utterly convenient for both parties to argue. Whatever they are arguing today, they argue the exact opposite just 6 months, 6 years ago. This is the insanity of politics. People who are unprincipled beyond belief. It's on both sides of the aisle that we see a concentration of disingenuous cowards.
Well, David, you know what it reminds me of? When my wife and I first got married, we used credit cards too often. And we got to the point where when we finally paid them off, when something new would show up in the house, we'd look at the other one and say, did you charge that? And, you know, of course, over time, we started saying, no, we didn't charge it, and we actually paid for things. But to do that 107 times, in a way, it's, did you charge that again?
But then to wash your hands of it and say, well, it's not us, it's the other party.
Right.
Yet we're being held hostage. Who's holding who hostage? It is the political class which is holding the American public hostage and not paying attention to the larger structural issues. We have made too many obligations, too many promises, and there is no way to get in front of the debt levels that we have already, let alone adding to them. We're forgetting the primary point of the conversation, which needs to be held, which is we're moving towards a debt debacle here in the United States, if not addressed immediately, and that may be precipitated by something as simple as the debt ceiling, and a downgrade to our national credit, which could precipitate higher interest rates, and that one thing, which if you recall Alan Greenspan's comment going back 5-10 years ago, it is interest payments, which are the uncontrollable budget item.
Right.
Interest payments, because remember, that's the fourth biggest line item in the budget. Rates rise for any reason in terms of our national debt. If interest rates rise for any reason, you've got the fourth largest budget item, which will eclipse all others. And now you have that issue of the Department of Debt, which appears to be in control today.
So what you're saying, it's a redefinition of, it used to be called a treasury because there was something in it.
No. I think this is Jim Grant's brilliance, just in its simplicity. The Department of Debt is what it should be called. It's not the treasury. There's no treasure in the treasury. There's
right.
no treasure. If there's no treasure in the treasury, a rebranding is in order. I think Jim's right. The treasury is anything but a treasury. It is the Department of Debt. But the Department of Debt is in control until it's not.
Well, and interest rates are a big factor in that. You know, as the dollar starts to lose credibility, okay, worldwide, we have to pay more interest to those who are going to loan us money. That hasn't happened yet. We've had this zero interest rate policy. But, David, you talk about it being the fourth item down as far as the interest that we pay on our debt, and that could go from fourth to third to second to first very quickly. We're talking only a few points of interest rise to do that.
Well, and this is something we highlight in this most recent DVD, which will be out in a matter of days, certainly before the inauguration. And it is this issue of if we return to the average level of interest payments that we've had over the last 20 to 30 years, we're not talking about $30 billion as an interest payment. We're talking about $90 billion
right.
as an interest payment, which would be the equivalent of 42% of all of our revenues. 42% of all of our revenues going to one line item, namely the interest component. We're not paying down our debt. That's just to keep our creditors from forcing default, from putting us into the awkward position of calling the loans. I mean, this...
It's just purely interest. It's like a credit card. Going back to that analogy where you pay, you know, $500, $600 a month and realize you're not paying down your debt, but just a few dollars. It's all interest.
That's that $30 billion number today, which is likely going to be 90 over the next 3 to 5 years.
Yeah. Well, David, it's amazing. You know, we've been printing money. We've had zero interest rate policies, yet our GDP, it still stinks. All right. Now, if we go across the ocean, I know there's a lot of hope that's tied to the emerging markets, to China. Are we going to get GDP from the other side? You know, when it's dark here, it's light there. I'm wondering if that's the case with GDP in China.
Kevin, China is amongst a group of emerging markets that over the last 3 years, which due to their size have shown fantastic growth rates relative to the developed world and specifically Europe and the United States. With every dollar of artificial stimulus in those countries, there's been fantastic growth, more growth. But you have to realize that the growth is actually constrained without government spending initiatives. You know, China right now is rebounding, but not on core economic growth.
Right.
It is specifically artificial stimulus measures which have been put in place over the last several months. Other emerging markets face the challenge of growth in the context of consumer retrenchment in Europe and the United States. And China has not yet made the transition away from this sort of artificial stimulus and investment towards being a consumption-oriented economy. That may be the long-term goal. They may achieve that objective, but we are seeing things move the opposite direction. Right now, we have power consumption growth, which is in steep decline. It's at about 5.5%, now below the GDP growth rate, which will be for 2012 right around 7.4%.
So what you're saying, David, is a good way to measure growth is how much power is being consumed. If you've got GDP growing at 7.4%, you should also have growth of the demand for energy. It's just sort of a side way of looking at whether the growth is real or not.
Well, and the precedent of the last 10 years has been increasing GDP growth rates and a power consumption rate, which far exceeded the GDP growth rate, and now it's lagging. You know, essentially we're in a transition phase and one that doesn't have any guarantees. GDP is likely going to bump higher following the last quarter's government investment splurge, and we may in fact see those power consumption numbers grow again on a temporary basis, but these are all going to be sort of first half events. Our expectation is that in the second half of the year, 2013, China will leave investors largely out in the cold as we begin to see a decline. Now, remember that the declining trend in GDP growth, it means that they'll be contributing less on a global scale to global GDP, but they are actually moving in a healthy direction towards a more normal growth level, not the double digit that they had earlier this decade, and not even the high single digit, but towards a very sustainable long-term 3-4%, and that, I think, will move towards as we head towards 2014.
Okay, so David, leaving China, we go back to Europe. You know, we've for the last 2 or 3 years really focused a lot of our energy from the press point of view, even from this program point of view, on the problems in Europe. Now, you know, as you've said before, it's probably not going to end in demise completely, but it's still on the table.
Well, they're not out of the woods. And as we reflect on these Basel III liquidity requirements we discussed last week, we did watch subsequently the large French and Italian banks respond very positively to the news of the changed LCR metrics.
Well, of course, why wouldn't they? They were told that they could value anything as an asset virtually.
Yeah, so with changed LCR metrics, they, after all, have the largest capital gaps to fill. They would have needed to raise the most capital or at a minimum trade up in quality to paper that met the old credit standards. We saw shares rise in response to those lower standards and sort of the easier capital hurdle. So you've got European banks that had well over $1 trillion in new capital to raise, and that number has now shrunk significantly. Basically a new lease on life for the financial institutions. But the irony is, the new lease on life for those financial institutions is that they get to remain as they were, which is unstable and highly leveraged.
Well, and what's amazing, Dave, just like we saw here in America, the banks were bailed out, yet the economy really didn't feel it. Okay, the banks got their pockets full again so that they wouldn't have to fail. We're seeing the same thing with Europe. You know, I saw a story yesterday about the deforestation of Greece. People can't afford to heat their homes, and so they're going out and cutting down what little forest Greece actually has. They're going down and cutting it down illegally and trying to stay warm this winter. So we haven't seen employment improve at all in Greece, Spain, Italy. We're not seeing improvements there.
No, and Spain is worth mentioning, I think, just one last thing, which is there are exceptions to this rule. As the LCR metrics were coming through, that is the liquid capital ratio. The Swedish banks were already out in front of this and had raised enough capital and had put enough quality capital onto their balance sheets to be in excess of the old and what was going to be expected, the very high hurdle, by 30%, which puts the Swedish banks in a category of their own in terms of stable institutions in the European context.
Wouldn't that be nice to see with other banks where you're not forced to do something? They actually did it above and beyond what they were asked to.
Now, in all fairness, the U.S. and our major banks would be second in line behind the Swedish, followed by your continental banks and your banks in the U.K., which are the most exposed, you could say.
Well, David, I had mentioned Greece, but you said Spain as well. There are problems there that are starting to show up on the underside of things that are going to have to be dealt with socially.
When we talk about China and we talk about any country and what they face in terms of political problems, employment is so very, very important. The fact that the Fed has just changed the mandate here in the United States to focus on the employment figure, I think speaks to where we're at and the risk that they'd like to avoid from the standpoint of political destabilization. Why is that an important point? Because unemployment drives political instability. Another way of saying that is that unemployment drives people mad. And oftentimes it's mad people that hit the streets and let you know what level of discontent they're experiencing and what they're discontent with. Is it the status quo? Is it the elites being cut a different deal than they're cut? What is the difference between the hoi polloi and everyone else?
Well, and the danger for the government at that time isn't just the individual who's unemployed, but it's when they start uniting and banding together, you know, when you start to see union types of movements back towards the government.
You certainly see that new sense of solidarity emerging amongst trade groups, and it's perceived that banks and the elites are taking something from the working class. And this is what happened in Spain here in recent weeks. locksmiths in Spain have turned down work, refusing to change locks on foreclosed houses. Now, this is Michael Pettis, who lives in Beijing, but his family has a house in southern Spain, and he notes this because he was there through the holidays, but there is this sense in which social unrest will remain a theme in 2013, and there is this discontent and a growing discontent, particularly in the countries where unemployment is very high. So in Europe and in many other places, perhaps in the U.S., we'll see this as a theme that sort of continues on. Now, we'll have to see what executive orders are issued here in the United States that may serve to polarize the public and define, not necessarily debate, but conflict in coming years.
Right.
Policy is really a critical point here. Policy is the central theme for 2013. And moving past the point of financial market demise, the implementation of policy will take center stage and either gradually help things get better or cause even more damage. And that's really where the verdict is out.
Well, David, one of the things that's the most fragile within a country, of course, is the social stability of the government and the people. But there's a fragility also that extends worldwide, what we call globalization. You know, it's the cooperation between countries. And that really does break down. When you have unemployment within various countries and they're starting to blame the poor or blaming the rich or blaming the government, you also then have governments who take cover and start penalizing anyone who does business outside of their own borders.
It's not appropriate at this point to say that the global crisis is finished, but we could say that stage one of the global crisis is complete. And now we are at that stage where policies make all the difference. Now things will be policy driven for better or for worse.
Right.
And this is the juncture we suggested 5 years ago. 5 years ago would represent the danger zone for international geopolitical or geoeconomic conflict. You've got domestic policy priorities, which often ruffle the feathers of trade partners, leading to reactions and potentially a breakdown in international cooperation. Globalization is pressured as you have these domestic politicians fight for power retention, mm-hmm. and they essentially take off the gloves. Partisan politics becomes more aggressive, finger-pointing, scapegoating, which can take domestic concerns into the international sphere very quickly. And not that that's some sort of a deterministic outcome, that we will end up in some sort of an international conflict.
No, but this is a historic repetition. I mean, this is something that happens over and over.
Well, and where we do see a repetition, it's not exactly the same, but it's very similar, because the nature of man is more or less constant, and thus is to some degree predictable.
Actually, one of the ways that international cooperation breaks down also is in the form of currency war. We've talked about it before, where if one country is devaluing their currency, another country is going to devalue it even more so that they can stay competitive in the market. And Japan has been an exception to the rule until now.
Right. So those reflationary or inflationary policies, Japan is going big, or that's at least what they're suggesting. And I think they've learned a lot from the Fed. Talking big is the first and most important resource to utilize as a central bank. So that quote-unquote developing a communication strategy, which the Fed has been trying to practice and utilize over the last year or so, developing a communication strategy in the name of transparency is really just a way of talking your policy agenda into reality.
It's manipulating perception, Dave.
Creating self-fulfilling prophecies. You've got central bankers that know full well that monetary policy is one of the many determinants for asset allocators and investors the world over. So to manipulate the capital markets via suggesting actions or anticipated actions, that has proven as more effective, frankly, than the actions themselves.
Mm.
So now you have the Bank of Japan with a new head soon to be appointed, which may play that role in Asia. Will currency devaluation be the cure for Japan, or will the cure of one disease be the cause of another, perhaps even more dangerous?
And again, David, we're not talking about evil people trying to create evil in the world. They actually think they're trying to do good. I mean, the policies that they're putting into effect, they think will work.
Yeah, bad policies are never enacted because people believe they'll fail or believe they're bad. Inflation, or reflation, as some like to call it, is the policy tool which has increased global central bank balance sheets over the last 3 to 4 years to roughly $14 trillion in aggregate. That's all your world central bank balance sheets combined. Of course, the two largest of those is the ECB, mm-hmm. European Central Bank, and the Fed. Now, this growth in central bank balance sheets was in response to consumer retrenchment. If consumers are not willing to come out of their shells, even with this vote of confidence sustained by the world's central banks, then central banks can then begin to trickle out some of that liquidity and threaten inflation, which creates an urgency. When you threaten inflation and you create a sense of urgency, consumers want to buy today.
Right, because it's going up tomorrow.
Exactly. They're thinking that prices will be higher tomorrow for the same goods and services. So let's just hope that those trillions, 14 trillion to be precise, don't radically reprice real assets and cause the same sort of social and political upheaval which past inflations have caused. As we know, a trickle has been known to become a flood. But again, perhaps this time is different.
You know, it reminds me of the book Reinhardt and Rogoff wrote by the same title, Dave. This time it's different.
Now, the irony, we started out by talking about Congress and the White House and Mr. Obama. He has appointed Jack Lew to be the new Treasury chief, again, the head of the Department of Debt. And he is every bit the socialist we find in Obama. In a second term, Obama is essentially surrounding himself with the party's left-wing loyalists, and it promises to be a very interesting four-year. The best thing I think we can hope for or pray for is gridlock. But when you look at Jack Lew and the fact that he's coming into the Treasury Department, the Bank of Japan may, in fact, be his best friend there at the Department of Debt. They're talking about the Bank of Japan is discussing, and particularly Abe, and sort of tearing down the walls of separation between politics and central banks. He's saying basically that we'll be buying $500 billion worth of U.S. treasuries. Some estimates by Wall Street firms put the number as high as $1 trillion in treasury buying schemes. Again, the Japanese stepping in and buying U.S. treasuries. They already have $1.13 trillion. To double that would be a great benefit to us. Obviously, that would take the 10-year treasury here in the United States to probably 1%, down off of its current 1.83%, and to levels that we've never seen before.
Well, and you know, Dave, this reminds me, going back to the Reagan years, I'm thinking 30 years ago, back in 1983, we were just coming out of a recession, and Reagan was looking at another election year, and you know, he sat down. We had had, from George Washington to Jimmy Carter, a buildup of $1 trillion in debt. I mean, it took that many years to get there. But in 1983, I remember they sat down and said, where are we going to get the money that we need to continue and get this election done? You know, Reagan wanted to continue to work on the Cold War politics that he was trying to work through. The point is, Japan was who we went to. We went from a $1 trillion debt to a $3 trillion debt in just a matter of a couple of years based on this cooperation with Japan.
And this goes back to what we were saying earlier. We've raised that debt ceiling so many times, 107 times. This would only be the 108th time. I mean, who's fretting about one move higher when we've done this over and over and over and over and over and over and over again?
Well, I'll tell you, though, Dave, there are some people who are starting to see the handwriting on the wall because Bundesbank is repatriating their gold. We've got China buying a whole lot of gold that they're not telling us about. Guys are starting to say, you know what, you can't do this forever with the dollar.
Well, and all that is to say that the fuse is lit. And that's why we titled this year's DVD, The Fuse is Lit.
Right.
Ultimately, it's not a fuse that is tied to an incendiary device in Europe, in China, but in fact to the U.S. dollar and debt markets.
Well,
the long-term concern is focused on those two issues, the U.S. dollar and debt markets.
How desperate are we really when we're talking about a trillion-dollar platinum coin? Now, Dave, we sell coins, right? We've got clients who've owned them for years. A trillion-dollar platinum coin, that just sounded like a divisive scheme.
Well, what you're talking about, I mean, this is a good reason why folks around the world are losing confidence in the U.S. political class. When you suggest taking a $1,695 coin and calling it a trillion-dollar coin, a one-ounce platinum coin, calling it a trillion-dollar coin,
right,
and making that available for payments of your debt, no wonder Germany wants control of its physical gold assets. The Bundesbank, talking about repatriating gold in the face of the insanity that they see here in the United States. I mean, this is the circus-like behavior here in the U.S., which has created not confidence, but actually quite the opposite.
Well, and David, they're not bringing back a little bit of gold. We're not talking about, you know, 1,000 ounces, 5,000 ounces. We're talking tons.
Well, yeah, and they may leave some here, but the suggestion is that they may take most of their 45% allocation. They've got close to 3,400 tons. 45% or close to it would be right around 1,500 tons moved to Frankfurt from the New York Fed. They're also emphatic about bringing back the 370 tons, which they have sitting at the Bank of France. Now, again, they're bringing that back to Germany. You've got Holland's government, that is François Hollande's government in Paris, which appears to be on an equal footing with Monsieur Obama. I mean, this is a really interesting turn of events. Germany, as recently as November, reiterated their comfort level with maintaining gold reserves with the Fed in the United States. What has changed since the election? We asked the question, did the election change something?
Somebody must have smelled a rat.
Well, that's right. What do central bankers need as a motivator in order to make a shift such as this, when the metals have been there in varying quantities since the 1950s? I mean, consider this. Is it the full faith or is it the credit of the United States, which is quickly coming into question?
Okay, so David, there is a lack of credibility in our government when they try to come up with the craziness of a trillion-dollar platinum coin. But we also have relatively still free markets. People can go out and buy stock if they want to buy stock, and the stock market's been holding up so far. Well, you know, what are your thoughts as far as the voting of the public with their money?
About 6 months ago, Alan Newman joined us on the program, and he does a lot of technical analysis, looks at statistics, and his assumption is that we're moving towards at least a 1,000-point drop in the Dow. A decline, again, predicated on bear funds. This is funds that bet short on the market, being the lowest they've been in a decade, and investor sentiment approaching levels that preceded the last 7 to 10% decline going back to September of last year. So there's that issue of sort of overconfidence. You've got the VIX, which is the volatility index, at record lows, and you've got a number of things that are very concerning as far as we're concerned here in the early part of earnings season. The Wells Fargo numbers tell us a story, which we'll get to in just a minute. Alcoa, while they met their number of 6 cents, they gave us no real forward guidance that was positive. They're expecting to see a little bit of growth in China, which was the positive note. But in fact, if you compare where their sales, where their revenues are today versus where they were 4 years ago, it's still an ugly picture. So there's a little bit of improvement. But again, they didn't beat expectations, and that tends to set the tone for the entire earnings season. If they beat expectations, there's an upbeat tone throughout the earnings season. If they completely miss, it's a negative tone, and all we got was neutral. What makes Wells Fargo so interesting is that they are being squeezed, and the financials are being squeezed. I think this is very, very important, because as go the financials, so go the market. Your net interest margin, that gap between what a bank borrows at and lends at, again, they capture the margin in between, that's at its lowest level in 50 years. And so again, you've got the financials which are being squeezed and pressured, and this is in spite of the regulatory changes which we talked about relating to Basel III here in the United States, because the Fed policy has flattened the yield curve.
On David, mortgage rates are just as low as they've ever been, and that there has been a refinancing boom because of the yield curve being low. You've got people who are the losers who are not earning interest on their money. That's the saver, okay, the retired saver. But you also have the person who still owes on a mortgage, who's gone in and refinanced, maybe refinanced two or three times. Does that seem to be waning at this point?
It does seem to be waning, and we may see a continual fade in terms of that refinance boom. So we've got a couple of things. When you look at the financials, not particularly healthy. We've got retail sales figures, which are coming in as expected low, and showing that discounting was what was driving volumes through the holiday season. So less than spectacular retail sales, a refinance boom that's fading, Wells Fargo numbers which are lackluster because their net interest margin is shrinking and is now at 50-year lows, and Alcoa, which is just flat. This is an environment where you need to be blowing out numbers to bring enthusiasm back to the street, and there is no enthusiasm because they're not blowing out numbers. By blowing out numbers, I mean beating expectations. We're not doing that, which means really we're in a very fragile and frail situation. Anything can cause a slippage in price in the Dow, and it may be what we'd started talking about today, which is this reflection on failed leadership and the debt ceiling. The debt ceiling may be that precipitating event, but you should know it's not because of the debt ceiling. There's an entire background that is not supportive to higher equity prices.
Well, and David, you know, as we talk about the stock market possibly losing 1,000 points, as we talk about the bond market not really being a place to be long term, because interest rates can only do one thing at some point, and that's rise. Gold. We've talked over and over about the consolidations in the gold market and the new highs that are hit after the consolidation. Over the last 10 years, we've had, now, this is the fourth consolidation. The consolidations tend to be about 12 to 15 to 17 months long. We're right now entering, I believe, month 16 of the consolidation since the last high in August of 2011. What are your thoughts on gold as we near the end of this consolidation?
Well, just as sentiment in the stock market is incredibly bullish, so sentiment in the gold market is incredibly bearish. It's not that gold bulls have turned around and said, okay, the world is a happier and better place, and therefore I should go put my assets to work for me in more productive places. In fact, they don't feel that way at all. But they are, because of the duration, because of the length of time this consolidation has taken, they're feeling rather boorish or rather discouraged. Right. And what they should realize is that after every period of consolidation, in the last 12 years, we have seen a minimum of 50% improvement in price. A minimum.
Right.
With the largest gains being the most recent run higher of probably 90%. So, you know, these periods of consolidation do occur, and following those periods of consolidation, you have major moves higher. We think we'll see a challenge at 1800. We think we'll see a challenge at 2000, but it's almost without that question that we passed the 2000 barrier in the year 2013. There will be a pretty big fight at the 2000 mark, being a round number, but I think you begin to see a recalibration of people's expectations and really of investors' imaginations of where gold can go breaking through that round number. When we get through 2000, it wouldn't surprise us to see 2400 in very short order, again, as investors flock to what seems to be a successful momentum trade. At that point, we think the price will drop back to 2000. Not on a permanent basis, but again, the same kind of consolidation we've just seen, we'll see another period of consolidation. But I don't think you'll ever get the chance to buy at these prices again. I think really we're at the end of a consolidation. You've seen 1500, you've seen 1600. We're getting ready to break the 1700 barrier on our way to 1800. The consolidation, in terms of time frame, is done. Now the question is, did the technical support, and is there something fundamental that drives more buyers and the price higher from this point forward?
So for those who are still waiting to move dollars into gold,
get off the dime, get off the fence. You've waited too long. Don't wait a day longer.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or just give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.